KALW.
The citizens of San Francisco have the right to know what's going on in their DA's office, and that's all we're asking.
Chesa Boudin's first year as San Francisco's DA ends in controversy.
At the end of the day, if something happens down the line, am I going to be able to live with myself? And it's all a judgment call.
Today, we'll look at the growing efforts to remove Boudin from office. Then we'll look at life on the other side of the carceral system.
I really never asked my son for forgiveness yet because I'm not out there. When I'm out there, that's when I want to ask them for forgiveness, because I do feel their pain when they talk to me.
Yeah.
And I do understand it, because I grew up without a father.
That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin is not a bland bureaucrat who flies under the radar. He's gotten national attention as the top prosecutor in San Francisco because of his unique life story and his unusual and divisive pledge to end mass incarceration. But when things go wrong, that spotlight can be scorching. In this latest installment of our series, The Progressive Prosecutor, Holly J. McDeed reports.
It was New Year's Eve 2020, and in San Francisco, 45-year-old Troy McAllister was driving a car that police say he stole from a date. He was out on parole at the time. Police say he was high on methamphetamine, and he drove through a red light and hit two women, killing both.
As the car spun, the police source says it smashed into two women walking in the crosswalk and sent them flying.
But this is not just about a deadly hit and run. For starters, the driver had already spent 5 years in jail while awaiting trial in a robbery case. And while out on parole, he had been arrested 5 times, but never charged with a crime. NBC News spoke with the suspect's uncle after the crash.
I don't understand why they released him. I really cannot understand that.
Chesa Boudin spoke about this case on Facebook Live. He explained that when McAllister was arrested, the DA's office referred him to parole rather than charge him.
When our office looked at the cases, we decided because they were nonviolent, because he wasn't arrested for anything related to drunk driving, reckless driving, guns, violence, that referring him to the primary supervising agency, the parole department, was the appropriate thing.
People accused of violating parole can be given additional restrictions, treatment, or punishment by parole officers. But McAllister's state parole was never revoked, and parole officials have said they followed policies related to this case.
With great scrutiny and 2020 hindsight, we would love to have done things differently.
But much of the media focused on Boudin's role in the tragedy.
Chesa, right away, criticism over the way you have handled the situation, that undoubtedly is at a fever pitch.
I mean, including KGO's Dion Lin, who interviewed him shortly after the two women were killed.
Why are you blaming the parole office instead of taking direct accountability here?
This is not about blaming parole. We all have to depend on each other to do the job properly. Here, when Mr. McAllister was arrested on December 20th, the San Francisco Police Department neglected to even notify his parole agent. And we're going to take a hard look at why it is that we relied on the San Francisco Police Department to communicate to parole when we could have done it ourselves.
I feel like this is the response you give whenever we end up speaking to you after the countless number of nonviolent crimes, for example, where victims want answers and we get the same lip service. What is your response to them?
Well, Deanna, I don't think I've spoken with you or been on your show before, so you certainly haven't gotten lip service from me.
Some of Boudin's critics also thought he was deflecting responsibility, and they took action. The day after the deadly crash, an investor set up a GoFundMe account to raise $75,000 to hire a journalist to investigate him. And soon, an online petition was launched by failed mayoral candidate Richie Greenberg to recall Boudin. Meanwhile, San Francisco Police Union President Tony Montoya suggested that the killing may point to a bigger problem in the DA's office.
Many of the issues we brought up during his candidacy for DA's office, our fears have now become a reality.
Montoya called for an independent body to audit the prosecutor's office.
The citizens of San Francisco have the right to know what's going on in their DA's office, and that's all we're asking.
Nancy Tung, a former San Francisco prosecutor who ran against Boudin in the DA's race, was also critical.
As a prosecutor, I never rely on parole to make sure that a case is taken care of.
She says Boudin's office should have considered what happened each time McAllister was referred to parole.
I think that also once you take a look at the overall record of someone, what they've been doing while they've been out on parole, have they accumulated a number of cases, a number of arrests in a short amount of time while they've been on parole, that indicates that they have not yet been rehabilitated and that they actually continue to be a danger to public safety.
We almost never hear about the calls prosecutors make, but they assess risk every single day. They are asked to weigh consequences, like the risk to the community when someone is incarcerated before they're proven guilty. They're asked to predict outcomes when people are given second chances. Prosecutor Nancy Tung understands the power in that discretion.
At the end of the day, if something happens down the line, am I going to be able to live with myself? And it's all a judgment call.
Any investigation or audit into Boudin and his office won't tell the whole story of what happened and what went wrong when the two pedestrians were killed. Because it's not just about a case, a DA, or a department. It's about the complexities of how different players in the justice system calculate risk and make those judgment calls. Mission Local reporter Joe Eskenazi saw the outrage over Boudin erupt online and in the media, and he challenged the logic of the critiques. He says the rhetoric he's heard around this case feels familiar.
DAs throughout history never paid a price for being tough on crime. The more people you could throw in jail, the better. And if there were people who were still in jail that maybe shouldn't have been there, nobody was concerned with that. It was better just in case to have people locked up, just in case.
So Eskenazi decided to look into the specifics of the case. He says in the process, he learned the details of how the suspect, Troy McAllister, pinballed through the justice system. And he says this case is maddeningly complex.
Now, people are dead, and that didn't have to happen. We shouldn't assume that this is the natural consequence of all of the actions that took place. This is kind of a flukish thing.
Flukish, he says, because the outcome seems only predictable in hindsight.
We could predict that this man would reoffend, and we might even predict that people will be harmed, but it's very hard to predict that people will be harmed in this way.
And even though McAllister was arrested several times since being paroled, Boudin has said he did not charge him because he expected state parole agents to take action. So Boudin deferred to them. There seems to be a basic communication problem.
He was referred to parole, I think, five times in a short period. And at no point was there some kind of monitor or somebody going through that said, hey, this is happening a lot. What are you doing over there? You know, maybe we should take more steps.
Meanwhile, Pearl has said none of McAllister's arrest after he was released in 2020 resulted in any criminal charges by the DA.
The problem here is that these offices seem to have A, talked past one another, and B, the DA's office didn't seem to know what kind of repercussions these referrals to parole had on Mr. McAllister.
But there are other issues at play, too. There's also the new reality that changes calculations of risk. For the past year, the criminal justice system has been making decisions during a super contagious pandemic. Wes Van Teicher is a reporter with the Sacramento Bee, and he got hold of records related to how state parole has responded to COVID-19. He found parole agents were told to take a hands-off approach.
Don't go into people's homes to do the checks of their living quarters. Don't do drug tests. And kind of most pointedly in the Bay Area, supervisors instructed agents that they must not search for parole violations.
Parole appeared to be weighing the risks of COVID-19 and the potential dangers of not monitoring parolees as closely as usual.
Tens of thousands of inmates have been infected with the coronavirus. Lots of prison employees have also been infected. There have been deaths. And coronavirus spreads more easily in prisons, and people are more likely to die.
And even before COVID-19, the state has been moving away from incarceration and towards rehabilitation.
That seems like a laudable goal for the state. The thing that stands out to me about this case is just that it happened over and over again, that he was arrested and then released and then arrested and released five times in 7 months.
So given all of the variables, why has Chase Boudin taken the most heat? Santa Clara University law professor W. David Ball says people often search for the most simple explanations in the wake of deadly tragedies. And the simplest answer is the so-called progressive prosecutor is too soft on crime.
I dare say if somebody is really convinced that Chesa Boudin made a bad choice, then they should be able to go today to people who are being released on parole, and you should ask them, which of these people is going to get into a car accident and kill two other folks? And if you can't predict that now, then I don't know why you think that anyone at the DA's office should have been able to predict it then.
And that, Ball says, ignores the more complicated issues that often lead to crime in the first place, like poverty, education, and trauma.
I think it lets us off the hook when we have these very, very simple causal stories. Hey, if you let this person out, they will murder someone.
Ball can't help but think about the advertising blitz during the 1988 presidential race between George H.W. Bush and Michael Dukakis, then governor of Massachusetts.
Bush and Dukakis on crime.
One attack ad focused on Willie Horton, an African-American man in Massachusetts. He committed a series of gruesome crimes while on a state-run furlough program.
Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
Dukakis lost that race, and some analysts say the ad marked the beginning of a new tough-on-crime era, marked by lengthy and discriminatory sentences. Boudin is aware of that history and wants to right what he sees as the wrongs of the past. His campaign focused on the idea that he was a person who could help San Francisco rethink the entire equation and move beyond the simple solutions.
Simply sending more people to jail and prison for longer periods of time does not equate to public safety. It's not that simple. There are cascade effects. There are ripple effects. There are economic implications. There are social implications.
But releasing people from jail without support on the other side has implications too. During his campaign, Boudin also pledged to make every arrest an opportunity for intervention.
Transforming lives away from crime. If we're doing that effectively, then when people are in jail for 2 or 3 days, we can pair them with the services and the supports that they need in a way that keeps our community safe and prevents them from getting rearrested.
That didn't happen in this case. Instead, Troy McAllister was arrested and cycled in and out of jail. Boudin relied on parole to provide the intervention he talked about during the campaign. Parole could have sent him back to prison for any number of infractions, and that didn't happen. So police say Troy McAllister, high on methamphetamine, stole his date's car and hit and killed two people on New Year's Eve, and that didn't have to happen either. It's a complicated, tangled web of decision points in a dysfunctional system, and now two people are dead. The brother of one of the victims, 27-year-old Hanako Abe, spoke to NBC News.
From Japan, Abe's brother says while the family is heartbroken by Abe's death, they don't blame McAllister, they blame a system that let him down.
But for many of Chesa Boudin's critics, the solution is simple. Push the progressive prosecutor to step down. Boudin has no plans to do that. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks, Holly. That story was co-reported with Alice Wolfley. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Now we'll turn to the producers of the KELW podcast, Uncuffed.
Coming at you from Solano State Prison in the rolling hills of the Golden State.
And from the Bay of San Francisco at San Quentin State Prison.
This is Uncuffed.
The Uncuffed team just won an award for community journalism from the Northern California Society of Professional Journalists. Congratulations to all the producers for this amazing accomplishment. And in honor of their award, we'd like to play an excerpt from episode 2 of the podcast. It first aired in 2019. These are the guys at San Quentin talking about fatherhood behind bars, starting with Edmund Richardson.
My father stepped out of my life when I was 12 years old. So I haven't seen him for 20 years, but I recently got a chance to reconnect with him. So one of the things that I brought up to him was like, look, this is how I feel about our relationship, and we need to build this, but it's going to be hard because I'm in prison. However, my son is out there. You need to build this relationship with him. Whatever that we missed when I was growing up, you have a chance to like make amends with my son. Being a father and not being able to like step up like I want to, I feel like this is the perfect opportunity to have my father step up like he should have.
It's an interesting take to this story is understanding like what did our parents go through? Mm-hmm. Like my dad, for instance, like he was a World War II veteran and he was captured during the war and tortured.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he's from the Jim Crow South. Right. So in my home, right, like I would get whippings for like missing church. Like he would whip my ass, literally. Right. And he was a barber by trade, so I would get these whippings with this razor strap. Ooh. Right. His mentality was spare the rod, spoil the child, right? And so he felt like he was doing a good thing. But what has helped me get past that is understanding the trauma that he went through, like what was going on in his life that made him who the person that he is.
So, Bun, how do you feel about the topic?
What resonated with me with his story was when he said at the end, if I love myself, I have to love my father. And for a long time, I hated my father because my father was a Khmer Rouge soldier in Cambodia. I never met him. He died in a war. He was a mass murderer. Where we come from, being of that bloodline is a disgrace. And like you are the cause of millions of people dying. So growing up in the camps, everybody really hated me because they knew who I was. They knew who my father was. When I came to San Quentin and did a lot of programs, and I started understanding him and understanding what he went through. You know, he was a soldier, he's fighting. And you know, I had to understand that what he was fighting for, why he left, and I forgave him.
That's deep.
And for forgiving him, I loved myself and I loved him. So and now I have kids too. And I always told myself, when I have kids, they will know me. They're not gonna guess who I am, what I am, and how I am. So I've been away from my kids all their life, but I keep in contact.
Right.
And sometimes when I see my older son, I was like, what is this guy thinking? But then I see me, I was like, what was I thinking? I really never asked my son for forgiveness yet because I'm not out there. When I'm out there, that's when I wanna ask him for forgiveness because I do feel their pain when they talk to me.
Yeah.
And I do understand it because I grew up without a father.
Yeah, I feel
that. Yeah, man, just knowing that because of the life your father lived, it changed the course of your life.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even there.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't like, you know, he was physically abusing you or anything like that. It was just his reputation.
Yeah.
You like, it's basically like you were paying for the sins of your father, man.
I always believed that.
You know, and I just want to just say personally, man, you know, it wasn't your fault. You know, it wasn't your fault, bro. Yeah. You know, you can't be responsible for what somebody else did before you were even born.
Growing up, like I had a lot of resentment towards my father. I felt like Bun felt like I blamed him for everything that happened in my life. And then I'm in this exact same position with my son. Not being there, not supporting him, missing his football, basketball games, missing his eighth grade graduation, first day of high school. And every time that I talk to him, it's like, man, this is my situation. This is what I'm going through. Please forgive me. Mm-hmm. If it was my way, I would be there every step of the way. Every moment in your life, I would be there the best I could.
I think that's important for a lot of cats in prison, a lot of men in prison, men out in prison, men out there in society, you know, because I guarantee you, man, if we were to do a poll inside of these prison walls and ask guys who's had a rocky relationship with their father,
man,
I bet it'd be a high percentage, man.
It's like real 90%. High percentage.
Yeah.
You know, but
more,
you know,
more.
But just hearing you, just looking at you too, and hearing you guys' stories about being being fathers from prison, you know, there's a lot that you can do. You know, right. Even though we made those bad choices and came to prison, and, you know, we can't take that back. We can't take back the pain that we caused. We can't take the pain that we, you know, the abandonment that our children may have gone through. We can't take none of that back. But what we can do moving forward is stay connected.
Right.
Stay connected through letters. Stay connected through phone calls, you know, visits if possible. Yeah. You know, so so once we do get back out there into the world, you'll be able to rebuild that relationship. So we all have these issues. We all have these father issues. But we have two choices. We can carry on with these issues and continue to go down that destructive path, or we can choose to forgive and heal and move forward.
That was Edmund Richardson, Greg Eskridge, Chantom Bunn, and Tommy Shakur Ross at San Quentin State Prison. They produced that episode with Ton Tran, Nathan McKinney, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Andrew Stelter, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Eli Wirtschafter. Uncuffed is supported by the California Arts Council and the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. All content is approved by an information officer. For more stories from Uncuffed, go to weareuncuffed.org. Next, we've got an episode from another KALW podcast, New Arrivals.
This is New Arrivals, a socially distanced book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Lauren Rhodes lives in San Francisco. Her book, Unsafe Words, came out in September.
It's a collection of horror, dark fantasy, and science fiction stories. Here's one of my favorite parts from the first story, Here There Be Monsters. Two people drowned here, Violet remembered. Maybe they haunted the place. Maybe they'd grab her ankles, pull her in. Maybe the angry sun was actually warning her, trying to protect her. She stuck one toe into the water, poised to yank it back if anything threatened. Nothing did. The water was lovely, just a little cool, like a blessing. Violet shivered with pleasure and added her other foot to the pool. The sun slipped slowly behind a tree on the ridge above her. Once the glare had faded, Violet looked around in wonder. So beautiful here. Each leaf, crisp 3D, shades of green she had no name for, browns so warm she could wear them like skin. She felt such an immense peace that she couldn't even remember if she had a problem somewhere else. And then her boyfriend is attacked by a mountain lion.
That was Lauren Rhodes reading from Unsafe Words.
New Arrivals is produced by KALW's Lisa Morehouse. Find out how to subscribe to the podcast at kalw.org/newarrivals. And before we go, here's some new music from a local artist.
Midnight fades into dawn. We begin the journey across the endless space of time, from mind to mind, face to face, faces to faces, oasis to oasis in your mind. Move with time.
This is Bored Stiff from San Francisco. Their new album is called When Worse Comes to Shove.
It go, music is forever. I'm really trying to tell you we work hard. But remembers from the ground up, caught up in the rhythm like every other musician. But it's the only way I'm living. We do it for the love, but money makes it happen. Actions speak louder than words, but in this case, our words are action over rhythm. Bottle it all up and give it to the world. For every man, woman, and child is real life. And what I like is good weed.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Azul Ekman, David Exume, and Sonia Narang. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shirin Adil. Managing editor is David David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. All the faces of masses, what they teach.